listening to the iHeartRadio Talk Network, and this is the Evan Solomon Show.
What's up, Canada? Happy Tuesday, happy Tuesday. Zane Velger here sitting in for Evan Solomon. Evan's on vacation, enjoying some much-deserved time off. He'll be back, not next week. You also have me next week. He'll be back the week after as we queue up and tee up and get ready for that federal election. But a pleasure to be here with you once again. Zane Velger from Calgary, Alberta, campaign strategist, political commentator, and your guide for the next couple of hours as we have a action-packed show today. I'm really looking forward to talking about a lot of the topics that we have. In fact, all of the topics, I should say. But let me give you a quick rundown. I mean, listen, the story of the day, and if you missed it this morning, the international media was all over it. Kind of a bit of deja vu, because it seemed like we just did this with another billionaire boy club member. But Jeff Bezos took his 11-minute flotation into space. I'm not going to call it a orbit. It was 11-minute flotation and then came back down. We'll get your thoughts on that. What you think of space tourism? I've got a take. I'll tee it up right now a bit, give you a bit of a teaser, whet the appetite. I think it's going to be a huge dud, at least in its current iteration, a huge, massive dud. But I'm going to get your take, and I'll tell you why I think it's going to be a dud in a little bit on this show. We're also going to talk to Mustafa Farouk. He's CEO of the National Council for Canadian Muslims. Now, they have put together, after that harrowing tragedy in London, and of course, that's not an isolated incident, but after Quebec City, London, the rise in Islamophobia that we have seen in the last half decade here in Canada, in advance of a national summit on Islamophobia, they've put together 61 policy recommendations for all orders of government. I'm going to be talking to him about what those policy recommendations are. And frankly, heading into an election, which ones the council would impress upon the political parties heading into a all but certain election coming up in the next couple of weeks. So we'll talk to Mustafa Farouk in the second hour. We'll also talk about farming in this country, a massive, almost sometimes forgotten economic driver suffering like no other industry. And the primary culprit, climate change, and the unbelievable weather patterns that we have seen in this country. So we're going to be talking to a farmer in Saskatchewan, someone who owns his farm, but also is a board member for the a Canadian agricultural group. We're going to talk to him about what it means. We're going to talk to Todd Lewis from the Canadian Federation of Agriculture about what this current situation means for this year's cycle, but also down the road, what this means for Canadian farmers going forward. So an intimate conversation there. I also want to talk about TikTok. Yes, the things your kids use. And yes, if you are a millennial or a Gen Xer with the spirit of a Gen Zer, something you use. But more and more, this is happening to all social media, it is now evolving into becoming a platform for job seekers. That's right. You're seeing job seekers, especially millennials and Gen Zs, skipping the LinkedIn job search, skipping the monster.coms and the Indeeds and the networking. No, what are they doing? They're posting their personal video resumes to TikTok. And guess what? Employers are noticing. So I want to get your thoughts on that. Whether you, as a colleague of an employee, would be judgy of someone who got their job from TikTok. And frankly, if we've got any bosses listening, would you actually take that step to hire someone from that platform? But before we jump into all that, here's where I want to start today. I want to start with the Green Party. And you might be saying, Zane, we're heading into an election. There is so many things to talk about with the conservatives and how they're underperforming, and then the Trudeau liberals and how they're making these re-announcements across the country, making it so painfully obvious that we're heading to an election. Why do we want to talk about the Green Party? Well, there's one reason, and one reason alone, to talk about the Green Party. The fact that they're currently imploding. And to catch you up, they have taken, the council, the executive council, have taken a public war against their leader, Annamie Paul. They're stress testing her leadership. They are reviewing, up until recently, her membership. They have starved her office of financing, which means she can't literally, in the middle of a climate emergency in this country, as smoke and haze covers a large portion of this country, we don't have the leader of the Green Party with any resources to communicate to us. Why? Because her executive council is at war with her. They've starved her of her resources. And they're reviewing, they had a review of her leadership with a non-confidence vote that was recently, just as of yesterday, they backed down on. And all of this puts the leader, Annamie Paul, who, if you are not familiar with her, a Black Jewish woman, a racialized minority in this country, in the crosshairs of a party that has gone after her for sins unknown. And what we now know, as of yesterday, is that Green Party leader Annamie Paul says she's not backing down after the confidence vote and the review of her party membership was canceled. She held a press conference yesterday and talked about the impact the controversy is having on her.
This moment has been one of the most painful in my life. This experience has been incredibly painful for me and for my family, and I want to be upfront about that.
And she went on.
It is extremely hard to have your integrity questioned when you value it so much. It's extremely hard to have your commitment to human rights and social justice questioned. It was very hard and remains very hard to be stripped of many of the tools that I need to be an effective leader.
And she explained why she's not stepping away from the party.
And I also didn't want to let down all of the people, young, old, from different backgrounds, different underrepresented groups, who had asked me over the course of the last 8 to 9 months, is there a place for someone like me in politics? Is there a place for me? And I want the answer finally to be yes.
And finally, she was asked about the barriers she's still facing.
My staff, sadly, have not been returned to my office. I continue to be without staff. I believe that I referenced that at the beginning. So, no, I don't have that. Our campaign, for the moment, still has not received any funding from the central office.
Let's just digest that for a second. You got a leader of a political party, one elected from the broadest membership in her entire party, i.e. the members. They have elected her. And her executive council, while they've canceled this membership review and this non-confidence vote, two unprecedented things, by the way, they're still starving her to run an election with no funding and no staff. And here's the thing. The point I want to make is very simple. Annamie Paul could have quit. She could have left. But the fact is, we often view this too much through that political lens. And I'm guilty of it. I'm a political strategist, political commentator. And let me add my 2 cents on that. This will do irreparable damage to the Green Party. What the executive council have done will do irreparable damage. But from a personal leadership level, Annamie Paul is showing a sense of courage and bravery that I think we should applaud. When too many women have left politics because they felt like it wasn't for them or that it was too vitriolic, you know, take a look at Jody Wilson-Raybould. Take a look at Catherine McKenna. Take a look at, you know, Mumilak Kakak from None of It, the MP, who said, I don't belong in this house. There is something to be said about Annamie Paul, regardless of her political chances, regardless of her electoral chances, that she is staying in this, for keeping her sword in it, for not relinquishing that sword to an establishment that has said, this is not what we're up to. This is not what we want. Because perhaps even more important than a political victory for Annamie Paul is the victory that she has perhaps produced for those around her. By staying in, signaling to those that say, maybe I can do the same. By toughing it out, saying it, you know, to others, I can do the same. To persevere and sending that message to others, saying that maybe they can do the same. So listen, all politics aside, I think what Annamie Paul did yesterday is a tremendous act of bravery. And after the break, I want to talk about another impressive woman giving herself to public service, Mary Simon, our Governor General. I want to talk to you about a review of her leadership. Your calls and texts next on the other side. Zane Velji filling in for Evan Solomon.
At As the story changes, we react. This is the Evan Solomon Show.
Hey, Canada, what's going on? Zane Velji sitting in for Evan Solomon. You know, often you read a story and it just has an emotional resonance with you and emotional alone. It just makes your blood boil. Well, that's this next story for me. I want to get your take on it because you'll clearly hear where I'm at on this story. But let me summarize. So in about 6 days now, Canada is going to have our new Governor General, Mary Simon, sworn in. But while that happens, the Office of the Commissioner of Official Languages is saying it will investigate the process for nominating her after they received what they called a pouring in of complaints about Mary Simon, our new Governor General, and her not speaking French. And there's so many things about this story that just make my blood boil. And I want to get your thoughts on it because I want to know from you if you think this investigation into Mary Simon, who is going to be our next Governor General, who is bilingual, she speaks Inuktitut, her native language, she learned English, she went to a federal day school where she didn't have the opportunity to learn French, but now she's going to have an investigation into the process that resulted in her appointment because she doesn't speak French. Do you think this investigation is justified? I want your take. 1-855-633-1010 or text me at 71010. I'll lay it out clear for you. This is bogus in my mind. This is absolute horse you know what. Because first of all, when they say a pouring in of complaints, let me tell you how many. Okay, let me tell you how many a pouring in of complaints in a country of, 38 some million people, right? 38 million people in this wide-reaching country. What do you think the number, the threshold is to trigger an investigation? You think it would be a couple hundred thousand? You know, 100,000? 50,000? Yeah, try 400. They had 400 letters the size of your average movie theater. And that is what's triggering this complaint. Give me a break. She's unbelievably qualified for this job. Let me just walk you through this just so you know. And you know, many people have not paid attention to the Governor General appointment. And frankly, I get you. Yeah, symbolic purpose. But look at these qualifications. Headed up the Northern Quebec Inuit Association. She was a Canadian ambassador to Denmark. She took a lead for the government and the Arctic Council. She was a chancellor of Trent University, on and on and on. A career of 30 plus years. She is bilingual. And in this time when we're talking about reconciliation and colonialization, something like this just is a slap in the face to that. When we talk about having our first Indigenous Governor General now under investigation by the Official Languages Commissioner for her inability to speak French, which she's promised to learn, by the way. It's not like she's giving us the middle finger and saying, I'm not doing this. She said, yeah, I'm happy to learn it, to become truly trilingual. And she was denied to learn it while she was a child in the federal day school. If you want to do an investigation, here it is. Let me save you some taxpayer money. Mary Simon is eminently qualified. She doesn't speak French. She's going to learn it. She is bilingual. Case closed. And even if we talk about this, this is not a legal story. This is not a legal story. At the end of the day, this council is investigating bureaucrats that had an advisory committee for providing non-binding advice on a decision that the prime minister could make. And it's under the Queen's jurisdiction. I mean, there's nothing to investigate here. This is a waste of taxpayer money. But I want to hear from you. Tell me I'm wrong. You know, one of the things I will say as I take this seat for this week and next, I am open to having my mind changed. I will come in hot. I'll give you where I'm at. And you could probably tell that my blood's boiling on this one because I think it's a waste of time. But you tell me, 1-855-633-1010 or text me at 71010. Our listeners in Montreal, I want to hear from you especially. You know, we broadcast there. I want to hear from you. From someone in Quebec. You know, this is really a age-old conversation but there are some fundamental different parts here. Mary Simon is bilingual. We are in a moment of deep reconciliation. This is our first Indigenous Governor General. She did not have the opportunity to learn French. To me, all of that, what I've just said, the scaffolding there is good enough. We're a country that values diversity. Okay, let me get you some of your texts here. Who the hell cares? I hear you. Saying, yes, this is justified. We're a bilingual country. You know what? She is bilingual as well. But you have some support. Another text coming in saying, yes, it is warranted. This position, this appointment is important, and the candidate absolutely needs to be fluent in the official languages of Canada. So the fact is, we're a bilingual nation. We're in a moment of deep reconciliation where we're trying to reflect on what's happened with our Indigenous brothers and sisters, not just in the recent past, but in the past, you know, 100 years, 200 years in this country. But man, oh man, she is bilingual. She speaks her native language. Let me take a call here. Bram from Montreal, what do you have?
Well, I got to tell you, the first thing I'm going to say is Canada's not 200 years old, so Canada doesn't have to look back more than 200 years. But that's not the point. The issue is very simple. She is not a Canadian employee. She is the Queen's representative. The Queen is British. They speak English. That's the only language she has to have.
Thanks, Brian, for your point. Appreciate that. Yeah, and of course, Canada way more than 200 years old. Large portions of the TRC looking back beyond that, certainly. But your point is well taken. At the end of the day, this is made under the power that the Queen exercises. Yes, recommended by the Prime Minister, and yes, the Prime Minister had an advisory council, and yes, bureaucrats advised that advisory council. But who is this investigation going after? Ken, I think you may have an alternative view to Bram and I.
Yeah, hi there. The job title, if the requirements are for her to speak the two official languages of Canada, then she doesn't do it. She doesn't qualify for the job. Saying that she didn't have the opportunity, she, I'm sure, went to high school and university. She had the opportunity to learn French at any time. So you don't learn on the job another language. You might learn the policies and procedures, but you don't learn on the job another language. She can't represent, obviously, Quebec in their language when she goes to speak there. They are part of our country, and we need to be able to represent them as the, the Canadian liaison.
Thanks for your take, Ken. Appreciate the call. Appreciate the call, but disagree. I really do. You know, yes, first of all, I think she can learn the language on the job. She is bilingual. Secondly, context matters. History matters. Isn't that the whole point of having an Indigenous Governor General? Isn't that the whole point of truth and reconciliation? To say that she could have learned it at some point in time when she was in the diplomatic corps or high school forgets the fact that she was, you know, in a federal day school, that she was busy learning English, that she was trying to keep up with her peers in a language that she was also learning for the first time, i.e. English. So I think the bar here, yes, there's a letter of the law and then there's the spirit of what we're trying to do. But I think the bar here can't be so rigid, especially for a governor general that represents so much and is so eminently qualified that has promised to learn the language and is going to do so. I'll take a few quick texts here before we jump out for a break. They aren't investigating her person nor the barring from her position. We have a language commission for that reason. This is what they do. Yes, but who are they investigating? What exactly are they investigating? If they can't investigate her, which they're not, this is true, they're investigating the process. To Bram's point, this is the Queen's jurisdiction. She doesn't know French, not qualified, end of story. Another person, I'm bilingual, but also don't speak French. The fact that she's willing to learn French should be good enough. I agree. A lot of hot takes on this topic. After the break, I'm going to switch gears a bit. I'm going to talk to you about TikTok. That's right. I want to talk to you about hiring over TikTok. Yes, the social media Gen Z app. Would you judge a colleague that got hired from TikTok? And would you hire someone from there? Zane Velji on the other side.
talking to the newsmakers every day. The conversation continues with Evan Solomon.
What's up, Canada? Zane Velji sitting in for Evan Solomon. Hope you're having a good Tuesday, wherever you are in this country. Some of you might be listening from your workplace, and that's kind of where I want to take this next conversation as we pivot gears from that very lively discussion on Mary Simon, our next Governor General. I want to talk to you about work. You know, work has changed many ways of how we've, I mean, this pandemic has clearly catalyzed the changes in some of the ways we've worked. Working from home, flexible work hours, some of us realizing that the whole situation has actually made us work more. But I want to talk about seeking a job, finding a job, because there's a new trend that I find fascinating. We all have, before I jump into it, our own predispositions on certain social media platforms, on certain technologies, the stratification for which generation uses which platform, I think is deeper than it ever has been, with a little bit of creep in from certain generations. But TikTok, if you heard of it, you've probably heard of it for one of two reasons. You know someone that is a child, a nephew, someone who's in your family that uses it and probably is addicted to it. The reason they're addicted to it is because of that unbelievable algorithm that TikTok has formed, that proprietary, almost addiction mechanism. And social media is an addiction rabbit hole, but the way TikTok has done it is just takes you into this depth where it just glues you to the screen. Or you're jumping into it yourself. And as the volume of people on TikTok grows, employers are starting to take notice because job hunters have now started to post their resume, quote unquote, on TikTok. So those feeling limited by, let's say, a LinkedIn or some other, you know, Indeed or Monster.com have now just started to post selfie videos on TikTok and have let that powerful algorithm do its work and just find prospective employers on that other side. And we're seeing this all over. Companies are, you know, jumping into it right now. They're jumping into it and saying, is this a way for me to find prospective employees? Is this for a way for me to fill the gaps that I have with a bunch of my part-time shifts? And it's not just, you know, the fast food franchises. It's not just the retail. Tech companies are jumping into this. More sophisticated employers with long-term prospects are jumping into it, which is where I want you to come in. And I'll give you the number first, 1-855-633-1010. As always, 1-855-633-1010, or text me at 71010. And here's my question to you. If you are an employer, would you hire someone using TikTok? Would you post your resume on TikTok if you're not? Would you judge a colleague if you found out that Sally, who's starting next week, got her job not by submitting a traditional resume and going through that process, by submitting a selfie video on TikTok and letting that extremely manipulative algorithm do its thing and find more eyeballs until it found your boss and they hired her, would you judge that person? I want to get your take on this. 1-855-633-1010 or text me at 71010. You know, social media has always been part of the job hunt. In fact, LinkedIn has converted their entire platform, you know, to really focus on recruiters and job hunting. It should have always been that in some way as a more quote unquote professional social network, but they're doubling down on it. They're leaning into it. But this is different. And you know, here my take is quite simple. I respect the hustle. Any way you can kind of break through or break in, I respect and love. Let's be totally honest. The job world is a networked world. The job world is about who you know. And if you can find new ways to get yourself and your face in front of other people, in front of prospective employers or interested parties, I respect the hustle regardless of the platform. It's like, for me, it's the exact same thing of saying that person who works through every single cocktail circuit or professional development hour or, you know, the lunch sponsored by the professional association, and they're always there and they always show up. I respect that. I always do. And for me, that's my take. Now, my biggest concern is around these video resumes kind of strips away that level of anonymity. It kind of strips away that level of security that many people, especially racialized or minority people, might have with an application process. That is, makes it a true meritocracy. You kind of read the resume and you say, this person has the goods. I don't know what they look like. I don't care what they look like. I want to meet them. I want to talk to them. By bypassing that step entirely, are we actually leaning more and more into people who look like other people hiring people that are like them? We know that that's a problem in recruiting, that you hire people that are like you. And does this just double that down even more? That is my big concern. But I want to hear from you. 1-855-633-1010 or text me at 71010. Would you hire someone using TikTok to find a job? Would you personally post your resume on TikTok? Or would you judge someone if you found out they got hired through TikTok? Getting a flurry of texts here. I don't know if I'd work for a boss that would spend all day on TikTok. Well, fair. Fair enough. If their purpose was to find your colleague, what would you do? Got another one here. Anything is possible. I got hired by a college based on my IMDb credits as I hadn't made a resume in 17 years. For those unfamiliar with IMDb, the Internet Movie Database, so this person clearly a professional or in the trades of cast or crew and in film or television. No, I would not hire somebody from TikTok, nor would I post my resume on there. And yes, I would judge someone who was hired from TikTok. Getting at the contrary view, it's actually quite smart because employers now have access to the candidate's social media and can see how they live to judge whether they should hire them or not. Interesting point. By having someone present themselves for work on social media, your justification perhaps increases and your transparency to how they live the rest of their life also increases, or how they present to live the rest of their life also increases. Interesting text there as well. Regarding TikTok, we're in a desperate hiring situation. I think any innovative way we can find to get employees is commendable. As an employer, this has sparked me to look ways I can recruit on TikTok. And here's the thing. If you do, I suspect you're going to find people doing this more and more. We're seeing that many recruiters are looking beyond these standardized applications online or through networking sites. This is starting to become more of a trend. But there's also that added element of standing side by side or sitting cubicle by cubicle with someone who got hired through a platform that many people literally just see as a song and dance platform, as a Gen Z platform for socializing and meme generation. But this is what happens with social media. It gets repurposed constantly. And I think this is, I respect the hustle. I respect the need of employers on the other side of this thing. I respect the fact that that individuals are trying to get in on this in any way they can. I think each person should be judged how they work, not how they find or apply for the job. Getting that text coming in. Agreed. Another text coming in. I hired someone handing out resumes on a street corner. He had a good resume and he's still working for me. Any and every way. That's what we're hearing. Any and every way possible. I respect that, by the way. I respect the hustle of, I should say, both employees and employers. If you're an employer right now listening and you haven't made up your mind, let me nudge you in a direction. I say go for it. I say check it out. If you're looking for young Gen Z talent that's trying to put themselves out there that clearly might have strengths in being in front of a camera and presenting themselves or, you know, articulating, you can stress test a lot of that. My only concern is, does this just double down on people hiring people that are like them and kind of removes that meritocratic process in between. But after the break, I'm going to switch gears again. I want to talk to Todd Lewis, executive, a committee member of the Canadian Federation of Agriculture, the climate change, I shouldn't even call it disaster, the climate change that is here, the climate change is just causing an unbelievable harm to our Canadian farms. I'll talk to him next after the break. Zane Velji filling in for Evan Sullivan.
when important decisions are made, we report. Here's Evan Solomon.
What's going on, Canada? Zane Velger here, filling in for Evan Solomon. We've got a crisis on our hands. Let's be honest. I mean, a nationwide disaster that many of us are feeling the remnants of. You know, those heat waves, that heat dome. If you're on the West Coast listening to us there, the story a few weeks ago of so much sea life just boiling. Well, the crisis goes from the ocean into our farmlands in Saskatchewan and Alberta and other parts of this country. You know, farmers are in Manitoba are being forced to sell their cows. Crops are burning in Saskatchewan. I want to get more on this story with Todd Lewis, executive committee member for the Canadian Federation of Agriculture. He's also the president of the Agriculture Producers Association of Saskatchewan. And of course, on top of that, he's also a farmer. Todd, with your many hats on, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you.
I appreciate having you here. Todd, for those of us that don't have a keen understanding of what's happening to our Canadian farms right now, and I'm asking to generalize a bit, and certainly we can feel the heat, we can see the haze, we know about the smokes, the drift across this country. What's happening on Canada's farms, and what's happening, maybe I should ask you more specifically, on your farm?
Well, we're currently in the middle of a really a long-term situation where really since the fall of 2019, people remember back, there was a very wet harvest that year. A lot of crops were left out over the winter. And in 2020, we really didn't have very much rain. Last year's crop across a lot of Western Canada was growing on the soil moisture reserves left over from the fall of 2019. And, going into this year, we had very limited subsoil moisture. And now with these extended heat waves, we're into our second one now this year. And it's really showing up in our crops and in our pastures. And so livestock producers as well as crop producers in many parts of Western Canada are really feeling the pinch. And it shows as you drive across the countryside, you see stunted crops, short crops, canola that's out of bloom already. And if it's not blooming, it's not producing seed. We see the auction marks having sales this time of year. The fall cattle run that usually happens into September and October, and later on in the fall, we see cattle being sold currently. And, really in some cases, the die has been cast already on this year's crop. And there'll be places in Saskatchewan where combines won't come out of the shed this year. The crops have dried up and there's nothing there to harvest. That's in certain pockets of Western Canada. So it is serious, and it'll have a big effect on, provincial economies and national economy.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about the economic impact and perhaps even the food supply and the food cycle here. What does it, from your perspective, I'll ask you probably a straightforward question here. Is this directly climate change and climate change alone, or is there a cocktail of factors that we're seeing result in the year and the long term, as you've described, trend?
Well, agriculture's always been weather oriented. You want to find out what the weather's doing, just ask a farmer. So this has happened before 1961 and 1988 were years that are being compared to this. Of course, everybody always talks about the long-term drought in 1930, over the 1930s. So over the years, we've become much more agronomically improved, and we do, we use our moisture that is available. We produce more grain and more pounds of meat now than we ever did on, with limited amounts of water. So it's something that is cyclical. Climate change, nobody's denying climate change, but this is weather related. I think on the long term trend, really we're supposed to see more moisture in Western Canada, with climate mm-hmm. change, but we're through the cycle right now, and this has happened before, but boy, this is a particularly bad one here, and we're sure looking forward to see the cycle get broken and see some rain. That's what everybody's hoping now for. Now it might not help this year's crop, but we need to get that soil moisture bank back full again.
Talk to me about the human impact here, the livelihoods, the, you know, we've even heard just harrowing tales of farmers and workers not being able to kind of stay out in these fields this year just because of the incredible heat wave and then the heat dome that we've seen. Tell me about the livelihood impact, but also the worker impact that you're seeing this year, either it be on your farm or from the industry overall, from your perch.
Yeah, this heat like this, you know, day after day of plus 30, it's hard on men and equipment, as well as animals. You know, it's pretty hard to keep ranchers or cattle happy when, you know, pasture's in poor condition and water's starting to become short. So it's mental health-wise, it's a lot of stress for producers and farm families. There's going to be some hard decisions have to be made, you know, especially in the livestock industry, how many animals can be carried over the winter. And that's really part of what's going on in the livestock industry right now, is trying to preserve as much of the breeding herd so that, you know, cattle that go to market right now, they won't be producing calves next spring. So, yeah. You know, we don't want to have as limited long-term impact as possible, and try and keep as many cattle on ranches and as many producers in the industry, so we can have producers put crop in next year, in next spring.
Yeah, talk to me about producers in the industry, as you mentioned there. Like, what is this doing economically? Are you seeing people throw their hands up in the air and say, you know, I'm out, that this is a long-term thing, that this is just one weather-related issue, that this is now our new reality and we just can't stomach it anymore? What are you kind of seeing from the economic side and the business side of farming from your vantage point?
Well, we need, it's not only the government, we need industry support as well. Grain companies, there's lots of forward contracts that won't be filled this year. So we need some support from the grain companies there, to work with producers that it isn't a bit, to mitigate the financial hit from that. And, farmers are resilient and ranchers are resilient as well. And this has happened before. There are government programs, crop insurance. There's private insurance programs as well that will help out. But you can never replace, the revenue from a crop with insurance. So it's a difficult period, but we've been through it before. Before, and what ends up happening is discretionary spending, be it on new equipment or even some inputs and so on, will be down, and that's where the real effect will start be felt by the economy, and certainly producers, consumer spending will be a lot less than it has been in the past.
Todd, I have 30 seconds with you. Can you tell me a bit about what this year might mean to our food supply in Canada?
Well, fortunately, domestically we have a good supply of food. It's good, safe product for Canada. Internationally, we're not going to have as much grain exported. The railways will feel the pinch. There won't be as much grain available to get put into export position. And there's going to be a price increase. It's not a direct correlation between the price and the farm, what a farmer receives and what consumers actually pay. Is there's quite a variance, and we're seeing groups like packing plants and so on make record profits, but in many cases that isn't being passed down to producers. So I think we talk about grocery code of conduct and things like that, so it's all related, and we want to see the food supply domestically and internationally as robust as possible. And
I got to get out of here. Thanks, Todd. Todd Lewis, ED, Executive Committee Member for the Canadian Federation of Agriculture. After the break, I'll talk to you about Jeff Bezos and his flight and flotation in space.
You're listening to the iHeartRadio Talk Network, and this is the Evan Solomon Show.
Zane Velji back with you, sitting in for Evan Solomon this week and next. Oh, we're going to have fun this segment. Oh, we're going to have fun. Do you know who else was having fun this morning? It was none other than one Jeffrey Bezos. Yes, the CEO, or former CEO, now going to be chairman of Amazon, founder, the richest man in the world, did what I guess rich guys do now, spend 15 minutes in space and get subsidized billions of dollars, or millions of dollars in his case, hundreds of millions of American taxpayer money to do so. and then get a bunch of unearned media. It's earned media, but it's unearned in my mind. But let me jump into what happened this morning. Here's what it sounded like when Jeff Bezos took off to space this morning as part of his Blue Origin four-person capsule.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4. Command engine start. 2, 1.
No, that was it. That was anticlimactic, wasn't it? I mean, okay, listen, it's pretty cool. Anyone going to space anytime is pretty cool. But you can already tell from my tone, I'm not very pro this. But let me give you a bit more. So Jeff Bezos, after he did that, he was with three people, as I mentioned, and they flew to space with him, and they just wrapped up a press conference a few moments ago. Here's how they described the experience.
On how it felt? Oh, my God! My expectations were high, and they were dramatically exceeded.
Sure. I mean, I'll get into it in a second, but your expectations should have been high. I mean, the whole purpose was for you to go and come back, something we've done, at least the Americans have done 50 years ago. But anyways, he says it's changed his view on the fragility of our planet, these 11 minutes.
The most profound piece of it for me was looking out at the Earth and looking at the Earth's atmosphere. Every astronaut, everybody who's been up into space, they say this, that it changes them, and they look at it and they're kind of amazed and awestruck by the Earth and its beauty, but also by its fragility. And I can vouch for that.
Okay, so let me plant my flag here. I think you're already getting it from my tone. I am unimpressed. I think this is a waste and a vanity project. And don't worry, you will have your chance to jump in on the other side after this, Greg. So you know, hold your horses. But let me tell you why. I think there's a few things that really irk me about this. First of all, Bezos is part of a class of these billionaires, these plutocrats. You know, we had Bezos today, last week or the week before. We had Branson, Elon Musk, and SpaceX trying to do their thing. And what they're trying to do, just so you're entirely clear, is venture off to space to commercialize what they call space tourism. So the folks that were with Jeff Bezos today, including his brother, a former astronaut, as well as a kid, 18 years old, who was on the trip because the person who paid $28 million for the seat had a scheduling conflict. I would love to be that person. Those four folks are not astronauts, but they're part of this new crop of folks that folks like Bezos and others are hoping could be part of space tourism, which means normal people like you and I heading up to space for a 15-minute float. At this point, that current ticket price is about $250,000. So I'll talk to you about the space tourism side in a second, but the main gripe I have is that this is a waste. We are funding, at least in the United States, both our time, energy, and if you're a U.S. citizen, tax dollars for these vanity projects to do something that the government has done decades ago. In this case, NASA took us to space. NASA took the Americans to the moon. It was done together. It was done collectively. It was part of a spirit and an ethos around collectivism versus this vanity project ethos, which is about the individual. And I'm not loving that because I think it really highlights the fact that a misalignment of having the government subsidize these individuals, Bezos, Musk, Branson, to go to space for their private billionaire boys club, while things on the ground for everyday people just don't make sense. And I think today, where Jeffrey Bezos is lionized by what I'd call thoughtless coverage, decades after this was done collectively, just makes no sense to me. And as you watch the images of this rocket kind of rise and fall, you know, the main thing to remember is that have we kind of just now highlighted that, you know, this is a group of people that should be dealt with specially, you know, and you might be saying, well, Zane, we're not American. Of course we're not. but we are consuming the same media. We're consuming the same time. We're lionizing the same idols, so to speak. And these are the individuals, especially in the United States, and especially Jeff Bezos, that are trying to get this positive PR coverage while running a company like Amazon that is built on suppressing workers' wages and skirting taxes. And so to me, this is a farce. It's a vanity project. It doesn't make sense. But let me flip it to the other part of it, which is the space tourism side. And as I do that, I want to talk about where Jeffrey, I want to give Jeff Bezos his take first. So here's what Jeff Bezos discusses as the importance of space tourism and why he feels like it's fundamental.
We're going to build a road to space so that our kids and their kids can build the future. And we need to do that. We need to do that to solve the problems here on Earth. This is not about escaping Earth. Every time I read an article about people wanting to escape Earth, no. The whole point is this is the only good planet in this solar system.
He says all of this is about saving Earth. Here's where he continues.
And if you go into space and see how fragile it is, you'll want to take care of it even more. And that's what this is about. We have to take, and this is going to take decades. This is a big vision, but big things start small. And this is how it starts.
No, Jeff, that's not how it starts. It doesn't start with plutocrats going up to space and then trying to solve the world's problems. That's what governments are for. That's what elected democratic governments are for. That's what tax dollars are meant for. That's what our vote, regardless of which country you live in, is for. It's not to have people like Jeff Bezos, subsidized by governments, built off the back of low-wage workers and skirting taxes, do PR hits to something like this to build a private space program for him and his billionaire buddies. But let's look at the strategy of space tourism for a second, too. It just makes no sense. If we think about it from the perspective of equipment, you know, we saw that when Branson went up a few weeks ago, right, his stock price for his company, I'm not talking business, fell. It didn't go up. He didn't get the PR boost and then said, I'm gonna make this happen. It fell. And the reason for that is because the demand here just doesn't exist. You know, it costs $250,000 to get people to space. There's a very small sliver of people that can do this. And the waiting list, you know, we talked about numbers earlier in the program today. You know, when we talked about Mary Simon, how many letters would it take to trigger an investigation into Mary Simon? And that unbelievably small number was 400. Well, let me give you another unbelievably small number. The amount of people willing to go to space, what do you think? 100,000? 50,000? The amount of people that are signed up on a waiting list to go to space, 600. That's it. This is cost prohibitive. It makes no sense. You take four people at the same time. This is not what we need to be spending our attention, and this is not what the U.S. government needs to be spending their time on. I think space tourism in its current form is a dud, an absolute dud. But I'm willing to be proven wrong, which is why on the other side, I want to hear from you. Do you think space tourism will take off and will be accessible? Your calls and texts on the other side. This is Zane Veldry filling in for Evan Solomon.
Helping you through these unique times, this is the Evan Solomon Show.
What's going on, Canada? Zane Veldry sitting in for Evan Solomon. Oh my goodness. I can't stand Jeff Bezos. I went from lukewarm, don't like this guy, to now being like, after hearing his press conference, by the way, if you're just tuning in, I've been ranting about his little flotation to space this morning. I'm not going to call it a flight. I'm not going to call it an orbit. It was a 12-minute flotation. This is what he had to say. He said it's about saving the Earth.
And when, if you go into space and see how fragile it is, you'll want to take care of it even more. And that's what this is about. We have to take, and this is going to take decades, this is a big vision, but big things start small. And this is how it starts.
Oh, amazing. Excellent, people. So here's what you need to do. You got to shove out $250K to fly with Jeff, go up and float for 11 minutes, and then you can realize that the world is a fragile place and it might be worth saving it. Excellent. Come on. Oh, you could have me going for this whole segment, but this is not about me. It's about you. Give me a call, 1-855-633-1010, or text me at 71010. Do you think space tourism will take off and be accessible to the average person? Or do you think it'll be a dud? If you missed my take, I think it's going to be a dud. This makes no sense economically. It doesn't make sense strategically. It doesn't really make sense from the perspective of how it's being financed to begin with. Insert government subsidies here. But I want your calls, 1-855-633-1010, or text me at 71010. Do you think space tourism will take off and be accessible to the average person? Getting a lot of texts here. A lot of texts here. The irony is taxes help programs that solve problems, and Amazon is one of the biggest corporate tax dodgers on the planet. That coming to us from Neil. Absolutely right, Neil. The irony here is that the savings that Jeff Bezos, there's a long, complicated tax scheme that he follows that ultimately renders him paying zero taxes, allows him to do stuff like this, on top of taking government subsidies to do stuff like this, i.e. float in space for 12 minutes. Another text here. And NASA is now relying on these billionaires to get stuff up there. Quit your damn whining. I feel like that was targeted towards me. Hey, listen, you could call it whining. But the purpose of NASA, NASA's being starved. That's the reason. And why are they being starved, you might ask? Well, it's people like Jeff Bezos not paying their income taxes. This is a cycle. This is a cycle in the United States. All I hear is sour grapes and jealousy. Typical liberal. Do you know how much these two rich gentlemen give to charity? Do some research before you do your homework. Well, okay, let me do some homework. Not a lot is the answer. You might be saying, well, it's numbers in the billions. Well, if you, with your average Canadian salary, gave something like $200 a year to charity, that's the equivalent of what Jeff Bezos gives to charity. Let's not even forget on top of that what I just mentioned, the income tax dodging that goes on with this company. And I won't even get into the workers' rights issues. Quote, I'm amazed by the fragility of Earth. So you're going to donate your fortune to help profit from it? No, I'm going to sell tickets to my billionaire friends. Thanks, Gray. You have pretty much encapsulated where I'm at with this. I want to hear more from you, 1-855-633-1010, or text me at 71010. Do you think space tourism will take off and be accessible to the average person, or do you think it'll be a dud? I'm on team dud here. Another text coming in here. It's not our job to save it. It's people like him who pollute it more than anyone else with their giant factories and mass vehicle fleets. It's his job to save it. And I'd argue it's his job to save it through the taxes he pays rather than vanity projects like this, rather than wasting tax dollars like this. Another text coming in saying, I would like to see Bezos put his billions where his mouth is. If the planet is so fragile, why doesn't he donate $10 or $20 billion to develop access to clean drinking water, building roads so people can move from one place to another, pay for education? From Joe in Constance Bay. Another text coming in here. I wonder what the first horse and buggy carriage driver thought when he was the first horseless carriage. Yes, space tourism is a pipe dream. It's a humanity to dream. It comes from the filthy rich, then so be it. Dan from Guelph. Thanks, Dan, for that text. There is a part of what Dan says here that I really appreciate and agree with. Dreaming is what makes things happen. No doubt about it. Vision, dreams, putting together teams, taking from things from strategy to action, showcasing to people the possibility. It's not all about the economics. But for these guys, it is all about the economics. Who says it? It's them, you know, and Jeff Bezos's purpose here is to try to make this a viable business. He's not in it to save the world. If he was in it to save the world, he would do what was in his power, his might, in his coffers to do that. The American system would figure out how to tax him correctly, and he would be contributing to the democratic public way that we as a collective need to save the earth, not through the vanity projects like this. Another text coming in. I absolutely agree with you. He's full of BS. Don't insult us by pretending this is an environmental issue to save the world. Now, if this was all funded by his own money, fair enough. Do whatever the heck you want, although that does not become a moral character. But this is subsidized. There's no way this is a waste. Yeah, I agree with that completely. And I think you're agreeing with me, which means I agree with you. And here's the ultimate situation, right? Is that this is something where we need to be able to collectively act, to be able to collect, to understand what the power of collectivism is here. And to have particular individuals like Jeff Bezos control this, to have particular individuals like Jeff Bezos only realize that our world is important only after he can see it for 12 minutes above space and just come to an epiphany that our world is fragile is total BS. It's total BS. Getting so many more texts here. You realize the Earth is a fragile place and beautiful, worth saving, so let's burn tons of fossil fuels for more polluting. Yep. And listen, I'm not against space travel. Let me be totally clear here. I think space travel as it exists is awesome. I got a caller on the other line. Greg, I have you. I have 30 seconds. Give it to me straight, Greg.
Yeah, well, I agree with you. I mean, it's not going to be for the average Joe, the space travel. And if it is, it's going to take like 30-plus years to be cost-effective. It was like when the airline industry started, right? It's just the elite flew, and then we all got to see with the technology that advanced. The other thing is when Mr. Bezos says, he's like you said, he's got an epiphany how to save the world. Well, here's what gets me about these types of people. Sure, we have to do things on this planet as human beings to make a difference. However, there are laws of the universe that change how our planet is affected, okay? And like people got to look into that. Like there's a sun, and the sun has a huge effect when it goes through cooling. The sun's going to burn out one day, folks. We're all going to be gone, but that's 500 billion years from now. The thing is, there's things going on this planet that this planet has gone through before we could document it. We're in a cycle. There's things we can do to improve it. I agree 100%. But to think that these people have the audacity to come down from a 12-minute flight and just hand us some holy grail, plan in their minds. Bull crap, and I'm sick of it. I am sick of it, period.
I appreciate it, Greg. Oh, man, there's just so much to talk about this. And this is just the beginning. You know, this is just the beginning of space flight. This is just the beginning of privatization of space. We should go back, but it should be with a purpose. It should be with a spirit of collectivism. It should be a spirit of doing this together, not having some plutocrats do it themselves. This is Zane Velji filling in for Evan Solomon on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
From coast to coast to coast, the newsmakers talk here. This is the Evan Solomon Show.
What's going on, Canada? Zane Velji sitting in for Evan Solomon. Hope you're having a good Tuesday wherever you are. You know, let me get personal for a second because our next topic, frankly, requires me to do that. You know, when my parents immigrated to this country in the 1970s and 1980s, I'd constantly hear stories in retrospect from both of them. You know, we moved into a neighborhood in Southeast Calgary, affordable housing, low income, multiple family members in the same home. It's that same story you've heard and many of you have probably experienced. A lot of us crowded together in the same house. You know, my dad came here first to Canada. They then sponsored my mom and then, you know, brought her over, and then the grandparents, aunts, uncles, 11 of us in a townhouse. And there was a park behind our house. And I remember every single time, for a good 2 week stretch, that my mom would walk down there. I was probably 4 or 5 at this point. She would get called a packy. Just constantly, verbally, endlessly, just expected, just accepted. And, you know, while I like to think that our country has changed in many ways, the divisiveness that we have seen in this country, especially in the last half decade, which has just been staggering, continues. And what's been a result of that is more Islamophobia, more anti-Semitism, more Asian hate than ever before. In fact, more Muslims have been killed and targeted in hate attacks in Canada in the last 5 years than any other G7 country. Just a mind-boggling stat. And so, you know, that Muslim family that arrived here in the 1970s, my parents, I look at a version of them coming to Canada in 2015, 2017, 2019, 2021. And if things actually changed. And in the wake of the harrowing and absolutely mind-numbing and devastating attacks in London against a Muslim family, the National Council of Canadian Muslims has come up with a set of policy recommendations in advance of an Islamophobia summit later this week in terms of how we tackle this, how we and how governments respond to this unbelievable state that we find ourselves in. And to join me for this conversation, I have CEO of the National Council of Canadian Muslims, Mustafa Farooq. Mustafa, thank you for joining me. And before we get into it, Eid Mubarak.
Eid Mubarak to you as well, Zain. And thank you so much for having me.
So, Mustafa, you know, this report, which I glanced through late last night and early this morning, 70-some pages, 60-plus some recommendations. Walk me through it, because you've got targeted sort of policies for all orders of government, but give me some of the high-level points here that you're trying to get across for our decision-makers and our political leaders.
Well, I think the high-level points are ones that I think the vast majority of us as Canadians know and understand. It's that, you know, every single level of government has a responsibility to take action to end violent forms of Islamophobia, so stopping the next attack, and the systemic kind of Islamophobia, like what you were referring to, Zane, sort of earlier on, you know, with the way in which casual racism, casual Islamophobia has just become a part of so many folks and their lived experiences.
Yeah, and when I read through these prescriptions or these policy recommendations, you've got them broken down into different orders of government. Let me double click on one for a second, and let me try to be advantageous to the political time we're in. There's going to be an upcoming federal election. You've got some priorities and policy recommendations for federal governments, but let me ask you to broaden that a bit more. If you were trying to get your message across, which you certainly are, to political parties or whoever might form the next government, including our sitting government, what would you want to tell them as some of the highlights or the top line things they have to do on the federal side of things?
Well, I think that they're like, you know, we need to see, first of all, you know, that this is a nonpartisan issue. You know, every single political party endorsed the unanimous consent motion calling for the National Action Summit on Islamophobia coming up on Thursday, I think indicating that every political party understands that we do need to take action on Islamophobia. And so I would expect that in the lead up to an election and in platform, every party is indicating what they're going to do to stop Islamophobia, anti-Black racism, anti-Indigenous racism, all forms of xenophobia. But what I think specifically are three things that governments need to do at the federal level. First of all, I think there needs to be specific approaches to solving the problem of Islamophobia. I mean, we've had the Quebec City mosque shooting. We had the killing at the IMO mosque in Etobicoke. We had the London terror attack. We can't just keep adding on to this list. And so we need to see a clear plan from the federal government and Islamophobia strategy that invests in solving the problems that are in front of us, that invests in a national support fund for victims of hate, that looks at online hate, that tackles criminal code amendments, that puts forward and understands and analyzes how our national security agencies have fundamentally missed the threat of white supremacist groups. And secondarily to that, I think it means looking at ways in which we address systemic failures in government. So, you know, the reality is that, you know, while our national security agencies have been very keen to look at Canadian Muslim communities, Indigenous organizers, it seems in large part that, you know, threats like the Three Percenters and the Proud mm-hmm. Boys and many others were missed for far too long. And, you know, while that's starting to change, it begs the question why it's taken until January of 2020 for there to be real movement.
Yeah.
2021, rather.
Yeah. No, and you know, part of what you've also recommended, and I want to get your reaction to this, because this one caught my eye for a very specific reason, which was funding for more Muslim storytelling. And, you know, part of that, you know, I can suspect is, you know, the advances that perhaps, if you can say, mainstream society, you know, have made to even allow a conversation like this. You know, I'm talking to you on a talk radio network. We've both acknowledged we're Muslim Canadians. This is personal for both of us. So as much as we're having, you know, a policy discussion, we're having a personal discussion as well. But tell me why the storytelling aspect finds its way in those policy recommendations. And what are you trying to get out of perhaps the storytelling and having more Muslim storytellers and creators in the zeitgeist?
Well, I think one of the great, you know, things that I think saddens me so much about the divide that you kind of referred to, Zane, earlier on, is that there's a way in which, you know, Canadian Muslims have been cast as this sort of monolithic entity on, you know, stations like Fox News and on some, you know, Canadian broadcasters as well, some news outlets. That sort of portray Canadian Muslims as, you know, patriarchal, barbaric, illogical, potentially dangerous, having some proximity in some shape, way, or fashion to extremism. And what I think needs to happen is that there needs to be support for Canadian Muslims, given the diversity of approaches and lived backgrounds and expectations, to be able to tell their own stories and to be able to let Canadians know who we are as a diverse collective of voices. And I really think that, and I think the majority of folks who are listening understand this, we're not going to get anywhere without conversations or without difficult conversations. And we can only do that if we're talking to each other and we're telling our stories.
I appreciate that, Mustafa. Mustafa Farouk, CEO of the National Council of Canadian Muslims. Thanks, my brother, for your hard work. Eid Mubarak again, and assalamu alaikum. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, you know, tremendous stuff here, and really hopefully it penetrates as we try to make not just changes for people like Mustafa and I. You know, we've got a voice. We were able to have this conversation on the national networks, but it's folks that are caught in anti-Semitic, East Asian, Islamophobic comments, narratives in this country that may not have a voice. This work is definitely for them, and I wish them the best of success. After the break, we'll end the show with talking about something called YOLO spending. You want to stick around? This is Zane Velji, hosting for Evan Solomon.
Sorting through the changes, here's Evan Solomon.
Hey, Zane Velji here, filling in for Evan Solomon. Hope you're doing well this Tuesday, wherever you are in this country. You know, I want to switch gears and talk about something different. And let me read you a line from one of Canada's greatest philosophers. I'll just read you this very quickly. Now she won a photo. You already know, though, you only live once. That's the motto, YOLO. Of course, that beautiful couplet brought to you by the one and only Drake, one of Canada's most notable philosophers, better known as rappers. one of the you know, most popular musicians in the world. But that term YOLO, you only live once. And there's now a YOLO mantra, the only live once mantra, finding its way into how we're spending. Take a listen to June Cote, behavioral economist and professor of marketing at the University of Western Ontario's Ivy Business School. She joined the Morning Rush on CFRA to discuss YOLO spending and what she thinks people will buy in this sort of post-pandemic period where we're trying to just spend on discretionary goods.
It's going to likely be, and this is a prediction, less stuff and more experiences, because one of the only things we've been able to buy are things that can be delivered by couriers. And so we've probably, you know, continue to buy stuff. Now it'll be about getting out and dining and travel and, you know, being sort of out of your house kind of experiences, I think, is where a lot of this spending is going to go.
So she's also saying that this YOLO spending won't last for too long.
I do think the spending will dwindle down. I mean, back to normal levels. I don't think this will continue. Obviously, it shouldn't. As people, you know, sort of deplete their savings, hopefully they won't continue to spend into their credit card.
I want to hear from you on this. Are you doing some YOLO spending? And at the very least, if you're not, maybe I taught you YOLO today. But are you participating in this sort of pseudo or quasi-frivolous post-lockdown spending? Have you bought a few items? Have you booked a non-discretionary sort of vacation, non-essential vacation, so to speak? Are you doing anything? Have you made a purchase, even to kind of symbolize the fact that life is normal? You know, a lot of this is part of that. And I'll get to that in a second, but give me a call, 1-855-633-1010. Or text me at 71010. Are you participating in any YOLO spending, any discretionary or quasi-discretionary spending? What is it that you're taking part in? And I mentioned earlier that part of this is like to do with agency, almost like a psychological thing. You know, we know that, you know, as it's been talked to us by a bunch of experts, that when we shop, we have an agency and we have a sense of agency around choice. You know, it gives us a sense of what we're able to maybe acquire something new. It gives us a rush of dopamine. It gives us a selection. It kind of triggers a sense of we've been forced to be in lockdown. Now I've got a choice to do something. And that choice is around what to buy, how much to buy. It's almost a psychological, and I'd even extend as far as saying subconscious way for people to trigger a normalcy again in their lives. So tell me what you're doing. 1-855-633-1010 or text me at 71010. Are you part of the YOLO spending craze? Are you doing it? Are you engaged in any post-lockdown purchases? I'm getting a text here from my producer. Producer Hannah is saying, after a year and a half of working at home, living in sweatpants, I'm now buying so many clothes. Fair enough. I mean, I like that, Hannah. It's like I'm now just communicating to her over the radio, which is great. We could text each other over the show, but why do that when we can have a national audience listening? Hey, Hannah, I agree with you in some ways, but clothes seem necessary. I think you need a better answer. I'm just going to ask you to up your game here. I'm getting someone saying I'm buying a lot of fishing gear. I love it. I have Doug on the line. Doug has treated himself to something. Doug, what have you treated yourself to?
2021 F-150 pickup, a 2021 Harley Davidson, and a 1955 Chevy.
Dude.
Yes.
That's the trifecta. You know, here's
that's
the thing.
Right.
I'm not a car guy, but I'm an Albertan, so I know pretty much everything you're talking about because I've seen all those cars and vehicles on the road. That's quite the haul. Tell me more about
visiting right now from Kelowna, BC. I retired out there 8 years ago. I've been sitting in lockdown for the last 16 months. Haven't been to a casino in 16 months. Haven't spent a dime in 16 months. So I went out and splurged.
Well, good for you. That is quite the haul. That is quite the haul, Doug. Thanks for your call. I appreciate it. George, I have your take. You haven't splurged all that much. Is that correct?
No, I haven't. I mean, I don't know. I mean, if you're able to spend money and you've been working at home and collecting the same paycheck without any cuts, I mean, I haven't worked, you know, full over a year now. It's on and off, part-time, shutdown. So I'm trying to save my money to pay my bills. I mean, before the pandemic, economists and bankers were telling everybody, you know, half of Canada or, you know, three-quarters of Canada is working, you know, living paycheck to paycheck, and we're 3 months behind our mortgage. So I don't know how during a lockdown people are still making money. The economy was booming. Stock markets were going up. Houses tripled during a pandemic. I'm confused here. So I haven't been spending. And you're going to see all these people, they bought, you know, they got all these pools. Once it's over, all these swimming pools are going to get filled in. This is, you know, this is spontaneous combustion to me, buddy. I don't know what's going on in this world anymore. I didn't have that fortune to do that.
I appreciate the take, George. You know, as you say that, we're hearing from, I think a study just came out today saying 30% of Canadians are insolvent, right? Like this is a very, it's a narrow band of folks. And in many ways, we're kind of living in two separate worlds in some ways, because this pandemic, yes, has hollowed out a lot of the economy. I'm getting a bunch of texts here that I want to try to read before the alarm bell, so to speak. We purchased a 39-foot trailer last weekend. Perfect opportunity, perfect location. Why wait any longer? Always a place to go, and it's ours. I like that. That does qualify for a YOLO purchase. I feel like now, based on Hannah's text of clothes, I'm just going to mark things in or out as a YOLO purchase. Doug, I have you in. I have the 39-foot trailer. Both counts as a YOLO purchase. We have someone saying they bought a boat, trailer in a trailer park, YOLO. I feel like this is a record for the number of times that YOLO has been said on the show. And I'm happy to stimulate owning that record, so to speak. We've booked two vacations in Aruba, one in November, one in February. Got both for the price of one. Also looking at a new Corvette. Yes, YOLO approved. I agree. Getting another text, though, in line of what George has been saying. Are you serious? People have extra money after not working and getting paid. Must be nice. Who's your audience? In some ways, that's the beauty of the audience. I feel like we've got diverse perspectives, many perspectives. And let's not, you know, with the minute or so we have here, let's not ensure we dismiss the other part of this equation, which is the CEWS and the CERB and the government supports have just kept people afloat for so long in this situation. So we are definitely living in two different worlds, but a lot of YOLO-induced spending, at least we're hearing here, which is excellent. Excellent to hear that people are trying to take some agency of getting back to normal in some way. Listen, that does it for me. If you want to listen to any part of the show, download the podcast. I will see you tomorrow. This is Zane Velji filling in for Evan Solomon. Keep listening to iHeartRadio Talk Network.